tuned in to the Community Cats Podcast. Ready? Let's go.
Hey there, everyone. Kristen here with the Community Cats Podcast. I am the technical tabby around here, and I am popping in today to let you know this is part two of the Return to Field Saving the Lives of Community Cats replay with Brian Cordes of Neighborhood Cats. If you didn't listen to part one, you may want to hop over and take a listen to that. And just like last time, this episode comes from the audio of a live webinar, so you may hear references to visuals, but all the key takeaways translate really perfectly in the audio version. You do want to check out the visuals, though. There is a slightly older version of this webinar on our Everything TNR playlist on YouTube. So just go on there, search Community Cats Podcast, and you'll find that in our listings. In this session, Brian shifts from the big picture impact of RTF to the practical day-to-day decisions shelters face when putting it into action. He walks through how to determine which cats qualify for RTF, how to safely house and return them, and what to do when friendly or seemingly abandoned cats come through the door. This training really leans into nuance because returning cats isn't really one size fits all. It requires thoughtful judgment, individualized outcomes, and an understanding of your community's concerns, capacities, and laws. You'll also hear how handling complaints, combining RTF with targeted TNR to prevent future intake, and even lessons learned from the San Diego lawsuit involving quote-unquote friendly RTF cats. If you're looking for a clear, humane, and effective roadmap for community cat management, this session really does deliver it. Let's get into part two of Return to Field, Saving the Lives of Community Cats with Brian Cordes.
So we spent the first half talking about the policies behind Return to Field, and we're going to spend this half talking about how do you do it? What are the different steps? And this kind of lays out the flow of what happens with a Return to Field cat. So first, there's the intake, and remember, that's what distinguishes Return to Field from other forms of trap neuter return, which is the cat is intake and impounded and given to the custody of the shelter. So at intake, that's the time when you're dealing with the finder. So you want to be gathering as much information as you can from the finder about the cat. You also potentially want to talk about return to field with the people bringing the cats in. Then once you've got the cat, you have gathered as much information as you can, you're going to assess eligibility. Is this a cat or a kitten who should be in the Return to Field program? We'll talk a little bit about how do you house them while they're at the shelter, the surgery that's done, of course, the return, and then what can be done post-return. And we'll talk a little bit about how you can start to combine Return to Field with targeting if you also want to reduce the number of cats in the community. So information gathering, as I mentioned, takes place at intake. And here's the most important fact that you need to get from the finder is where they found the cat, what we call the location of origin. And if keep a couple things in mind. One is that where the finder lives or the address on the finder's driver's license is not necessarily where the cat was found. So somebody might live in one part of town, but have found the cat in another. So you want to be very careful about not assuming what the address is. And if there's some confusion about, like the person can't really quite identify the address because maybe they're not familiar with that part of town, you can always ring up Google Maps and kind of figure it out that way. But it's, of course, you can't return a cat to their original location if you don't know where that was. So the other things you want to find out about are the cat's history. Did they just recently arrive in the neighborhood? Have they been there for a long time? How do they behave towards people? Do they keep their distance? Are they friendly? Have any type of injury or illness been observed? Also, the circumstances at the location. Is there a known feeder? Are there other cats in the area? Are there any hazards like we were talking about before with, you know, potential cruelty cases? And then why did the finder bring the cat in? You'll be surprised. Sometimes it's because the finder may think that community cats are a nuisance, but often it's because they want to help the cat and they don't quite know what to do. And they think they're doing the right thing by bringing the cat in. And you may find that the people bringing the cat in may be willing to come and pick the cat up once you explain to them what the program is and things like that. But basically, that's going to be part of your assessment about whether the cat should be returned is why did they bring them in? Now, again, it's not a definitive thing. So if somebody thinks the community cat is a nuisance, that doesn't mean the cat doesn't come back. You know, our experience has shown that one person may not like the cat being there, but three other people in the neighborhood may enjoy the cat. So it's what the finder's feelings are is not determinative. But you want to assess what's the finder's attitude. Are they neutral? Are they friendly? Are they hostile? Because that might affect how the return is done later. Now, in the Return to Field Handbook, which you can download for free from Humane World for Animals, there are sample intake forms and questionnaires that cover all of this stuff, and you can craft one that works for you. So this does not have to be like an hour-long interview. Usually you can capture all this in just 5 to 10 minutes. So don't be intimidated by like, oh, you know, they're not going to stick around long enough. You can usually gather this information when they bring the cat in and they're filling out forms and things like that. So do you want to talk to the people bringing the cats who are surrendering the cats? You're going to talk to them about return to field. Now, remember, it's quite possible that they don't have a problem with the cats, but they're concerned that a lot of people see cats outside. And they just think, oh, that cat's in trouble, and they scoop them up and bring them in without really fully understanding community cats. And they may have other concerns. Sometimes people bring cats in because they think it's cold outside and the cat won't do well in the winter. They just have to be told, well, just put out a shelter and they'll be perfectly fine. So there's a lot of reasons why discussing return to field can be helpful. On the other hand, you know, if somebody doesn't appreciate the idea of the cat coming back, then, you know, you could end up wasting a lot of time and having tension between your customer service representatives and the people surrendering the cats. And so there may be times you don't want to deal with that. You want to avoid that. In that case, you might just list return to field on the surrender form that typically people sign when they're handing the cat over, and list that as a possible outcome so that there's some form of notification being provided. And again, if you've got people who are bringing cats in to try to help them, they may be willing to pick them up, and that will save your staff from having to do one more return. If there may be complaints when you ask, like, you know, one of the reasons you ask, why are you bringing the cat in? And the answer is they're digging up my garden. There are ways to prevent that. There are motion activated sprinklers. There are ultrasonic devices. There's fencing. There's ways to, if you put rocks on the ground, they won't dig in the garden, things like that. You can do complaint mitigation. And often programs, return to field programs, have a supply of deterrent, what we call deterrents, in stock, and they'll lend them out to people where that's the problem they're having with the cats. You need to obviously keep track of the cats as they move through the shelter system. Now, typically cats are being housed in traps, not in cages, which we'll talk a little bit about when we get to housing. But you can see here how Maui Humane Society has this tracking form that includes a color photo of the cat. It's very important that it's color. It's easy to confuse cats often if they're in black and white. And then that gets put into a plastic sleeve that's zip tied onto the front of the trap. And that stays with the cat throughout the process. And you can see there's, as the cat moves through the system, information is entered from intake all the way to when the cat has been released. But you want to have some form of tracking. And then we get to the big question, which is eligibility. So which cats should go back? And it's important to realize the goal of return to field is that when you consider all the known circumstances, the question you're trying to answer is return to field the best available outcome for this individual cat? And so the key phrase is two of them, best available outcome and individual. Where we see return to field programs get into trouble is when they do what I call an autopilot approach. So they say, all right, all the cats that are less than 4 months old are going to stay at the shelter because they're too young. And any cat that comes in from outside that's over 4 months is going back. Some shelters have even done, well, the cat came from outside, the cat's going back outside. And they don't look at the individual circumstances. And that has the seeming benefit of efficiency and a lot easier to make a decision, right? If it's all just a checklist, you know, they're this age or that age, so they go this way or they go that way. But it ends up with a lot of bad situation. Like I said before, there may be a very young kitten, like an 8-week-old kitten, who would have a pretty reasonable chance at a decent quality of life if returned, but faces almost certain death at the shelter because it's the springtime and the shelter's overcrowded already with kittens. And on the other hand, there may be adults who are better off kept at the shelter rather than automatically put back because of their individual circumstances. Maybe they're very friendly. Maybe it's not safe where they're going. So if you put your program on autopilot, you're probably going to get into trouble at some point with cats that don't neatly fit into these particular categories that you've drawn. And in the end, we want to do what's best for each cat anyway. And that's why we need to take an individualized approach and take the time. It doesn't take a whole lot of time, especially once you get trained in doing this, to look at each cat, their circumstances. Are they better off going back? Are they better off going into adoption? Is this a case where euthanasia is unfortunately the only or the best outcome that we can provide? Don't be afraid to ask that question and give an answer. And you're not going to be 100% correct all the time. And so it's a more difficult process emotionally and to implement. But in the end, we're there to help the animals, not to make life easier for us. So the first question is, who decides, right? Who's going to determine eligibility? Some programs have intake. The person who's doing the intake and interviewing the finder make the call on the pathway. What we found in working with Return to Field programs is so the people up front who are doing intake, they're often the most inexperienced people at the shelter. They're often the entry level, and they may or may not have any expertise with cats in general or community cats in particular. So what we found is it's much better if they flag cats, if they identify possibilities rather than making the actual decision. So if the cat came from outside, then you might want to flag the cat. And then you have staff that is experienced with community cats look over all the information and make the call on whether the cat is going to be in the RTF program or not. So when we look at the various factors that we're going to examine, first we look at the cat herself. And the very first question is going to be, is there any indicia of ownership? Might this be a lost pet? Is there a microchip? Is there a collar? Is the cat altered but not ear tipped? Things like that, which would indicate possible ownership, those should be, if there is something that can be followed up on, you want to do that. And you want to maybe hold the cat a little bit longer so that if there is an owner out there looking for the cat, they have an opportunity to come. That doesn't mean the cat's not going to end up being returned to field, as we'll talk about in a little bit, because, you know, there may be microchips, but it might be often the microchip information is stale and the cat might be microchipped to a colony caretaker, to a pet owner, and or the cat may have been abandoned or any number of things that may end up making it the best thing for the cat to be returned. So that indicia of ownership is really just a kind of a first step, if it's there, that says, well, investigate that further before you go any further with the eligibility evaluation. So history, I mentioned that before, you know, if a lot stronger case to return a cat who's been seen in the neighborhood for months than somebody who just showed up out of nowhere, right? The health of the cat is very important. So we're not identifying caretakers or feeders. But if the cat is coming in good body condition and there's no indications of possible abandonment, and so say, you know, you have a cat who's been seen for a while in the neighborhood, he's trapped, brought in, he's in excellent body condition, he's got a feeder, he's got people taking care of him. You might not be able to identify them, but he wouldn't be doing as well as he is if they weren't, that he didn't have some people looking out for him. So a cat that's in good health is going to lean towards a return. On the other hand, a cat who's in really bad shape, well, that's probably not a good time to be putting cats back in the same situation in which they weren't doing well. Age is, again, there's no red line on age, but it's a factor that you want to consider, whether they're older or younger, and that ties into capacity for care and whether you're able to adopt out kittens and things like that. Is there a disability? Is the cat declawed? Is the cat have three legs? Is the cat blind? Again, funny enough, not a red line. I've seen blind cats do great in certain circumstances outdoors, and they're quite feral, and there is no other alternative outcome, live outcome for them at a shelter. So it depends on the circumstances at the location of origin. So I'm thinking of this blind cat who lived in a pretty closed-in backyard area, a shared lawn among a number of houses, had regular feeders, had lots of feline friends, could run around. I mean, blind cats can be pretty amazing, but the cat was perfectly fine where he was. There'd be no reason that this disability would make the cat ineligible. So again, it's something to note, but none of these factors are necessarily red lines one way or the other. And then there's temperament, which has to do with whether the cat is sociable, you know, or friendly or not. Again, something you're noting. So like if a cat is very friendly and other factors are like, you know, the location of origin is kind of iffy. We're not so sure about it. We don't know any history. Nobody saw this cat before and you have room for adoption. Well, then maybe it's a better choice to keep this cat than to put him back. So we talk about the location of origin and we have already talked a bit about, you know, what is it? Are there hazards? Are there dangerous conditions in which you just can't, you know, you can't feel like the cat's safety is, you know, reasonably guaranteed. So you want to know all about that. Is there, or for example, did somebody trap the cat and bring him in because there's major construction starting at that site and it would be dangerous for the cat to be around? Is it a train tracks? You know, those are going to be the exceptions, but you need to know. We talked about whether there's a realistic threat of harm. You can't not return cats because somebody got angry or because somebody made a verbal threat, because people do that all the time and they don't follow through. You want to rely on objective facts, like is there a history of abuse? Is there, you know, something that is more than just an expression of anger? Are there caretakers or others waiting for the return? You may know about the caretaker. Sometimes caretakers don't take their cats to the clinic. They surrender them at the shelter. So, you know, that would be something to know. And we mentioned before, is there vulnerable wildlife present that it really, you know, you wouldn't want to be returning cats to the middle of a bird sanctuary, for example. And capacity for care is an eligibility factor that kind of overrides everything we've been talking about. So if you're in a shelter like this one, in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and this was after they had been running a return to field program for two or three years, and you can see all the cages were empty. So they greatly increased their capacity for care. And if you have room, then maybe you're a little more conservative about who you put back. On the other hand, if you have no room and it's kitten season and you're already overcrowded, then probably, you know, you're going to lean more towards it's better to put cats back and take certain risks that you might not have otherwise. So capacity for care is really a huge, huge overriding factor that has to be taken into account at all times. So let's get to that controversial subject, which is friendly cats. And sociability does not have to be an automatic disqualifier. Like a lot of people think like, well, the cat's friendly, so why would you know, RTF is only for feral cats and any friendly cat should just go right into an adoption. Well, what if there's no room for adoption? What if the cat's been seen in the neighborhood for months, right? So there may be times, or maybe cats are sociable in their territory, but not at the shelter. We've seen that where there was one kitty who went up to a local precinct, a police precinct, and started rubbing against the legs of the officers. The officers thought, oh, you know, poor cat. So they scooped him up, brought him to the shelter, and then he turned into a terror because he was so frightened. We recommended putting that cat back because he was not adoptable in a shelter environment, and he was obviously very comfortable where he'd been living. So there's nothing about, we had another cat. I'll give you another example of a friendly cat that somebody scooped up and brought in. And then people in the community started calling the shelter and saying, why did you take our cat? We want our cat back. And this was a community cat that was well-loved by multiple residents in the area. He was very friendly, but he was their cat. They wanted him back, so we gave him back. So keep that in mind. It's a factor, but it's not, like everything else, it's not, nothing should be automatic. The question is always, is return to field the best available outcome? And that may, in many cases, the answer may be yes.
When we launched the Community Cats podcast, our goal was simple: share stories and strategies to help cat lovers turn their passion into action. But something amazing happened. Our community grew, and so did our mission. Over the years, we've added webinars, conferences, certification courses, downloadable tools, and a whole lot more to support people who care about cats. So it's time for our name to reflect everything we do. The podcast isn't going anywhere, but our overall platform is rebranding as Community Cat Central. It's the same team, the same heart, and the same commitment, just with a fresh new look and even better ways to help you take action for cats in your community. You'll start seeing updates soon, including a brand new website, smarter email tools, and resources that are easier to access and use. We're so grateful to have you on this journey with us, and we can't wait to show you what's next. In a recent study, 97% of respondents said that pets are family. Communities can play a vital role in helping to keep families together, whether it's reuniting lost pets with their owners, donating pet supplies or funds for pet owners in need, or offering short or long-term fostering. People can help keep pets and their people together. We just have to show them how. Did you know there are resources you can use to help bring attention to the programs you offer to help them do just that? From public service announcements, short videos, printable posters, online and social graphics, and much more. Find your resources at www.petsandpeopletogether.org/campaign-resources. #BeAHelper. Tomahawk Live Trap exceeds customers' expectations by providing them with the highest quality humane animal control products available. Check out their new Pro Series Gravity Door Trap. They feature a door that sets automatically when you open it. No hook or plate setting needed. Use discount code KEEPITHUMANE for 10% off your order at livetrap.com.
What we find with friendly cats in terms of making the RTF decision, the two most critical factors are the cat's known history and the shelter's capacity for care. So when we're faced, and this is where judgment comes in, and shelters make their own policies, and whoever's doing eligibility decisions will have their own biases and leanings, and there's no right or wrong. It's a judgment factor. I know for Susie and I, when we do make return to field determinations, if the cat's friendly and there's room at the shelter for him and we don't know anything about the cat's history, we're going to keep the cat at the shelter and try to find him a new home. Even though it's possible he, you know, belongs in that neighborhood and would be perfectly fine there, we feel like it's too unknown. And if there's room at the shelter and he can be placed, we don't want to take that risk. Other shelters will feel differently. Their presumption will be, unless there's something that indicates there's a problem for the cat, you know, the chances that he may be somebody's pet, that we may be basically catnapping, is too high, and so we're going to put the cat back. It really depends on your circumstances and your leanings. Now, often the fear of returning friendly cats is that they may have been someone's pet who's now been lost or abandoned, and you're putting an abandoned cat right back to where he was found or where he was dumped. And often this is where interviewing the finder can be so important, because you can get real strong clues if you know how the cat presented himself to the finder. And I'll give you an example. So we've had cats who were friendly, who, like I said, were confidently walking around the neighborhood, who had been seen there for some period of time. That's most likely not a lost cat, even though he's friendly. On the other hand, we've had cats all of a sudden show up on someone's porch and not move for days. And the person who owned the home would put food and water out for them, but they would never leave the porch. They remained frozen in place until they were, you know, put in a carrier and brought to the shelter. That's not the behavior of a confident, comfortable community cat. And in fact, in that case, we declined and we said no return to field for them, for these two kitties. And then it came out that they actually were the pets of the neighbor who moved and left them behind. So how the cat presents upon being found, if they are seen and then they remain frozen in place over a substantial period of time, that's probably not a cat who should be returned and is comfortable living outdoors. So some of you may have heard about the San Diego lawsuit. I mentioned that earlier. And what happened was a local rescue group sued the San Diego Humane Society, claiming that their return to field of friendly cats violated California's anti-abandonment law. And the court ruled ultimately that temperament, so whether a cat was friendly or not, was irrelevant to the issue. And that being for the many reasons that we've discussed, that, you know, a community cat can be friendly, it can be feral, there could be all sorts of things. It could be a good thing to put them back, it could be a bad thing. But the temperament in it in and of itself as a standalone factor was not a red line that determined what was the best available outcome. So the court basically decided that you can return a friendly cat, you can include a cat in a return to field program, and that is not abandonment if all the other factors combine to show that this is a good decision. However, the court did rule that if a cat had an indicia of ownership, they had to be excluded from the return to field program. And indicia of ownership, meaning the things I mentioned before, microchip, collar, even a mark of a collar, even if it looked like the cat used to have a collar, altered but not ear tipped. In that case, the court ruled that would potentially violate the abandonment law and put that limit on the return to field program. So if you're in San Diego, you have to deal with that. But for everybody else who's looking for guidance, I would say that even putting that limitation is questionable. Because as I mentioned before, so what if a cat comes in with a microchip and the microchip can't be traced? Well, what if all the other factors point towards the cat's been in the neighborhood for some period of time, the cat's in excellent health, so has at least one or more feeders, is otherwise healthy, has no disabilities, there's no threats. Why wouldn't you put that cat back to where he's thriving just because he had a microchip that couldn't be traced? So I think that was a questionable decision. But overall, we were happy that the court at least ruled friendly cats, returning friendly cats is not a form of abandonment. So we talked about housing, and you want to keep the cat separate from the general cat shelter population, and especially from dogs. That's a disease thing. As I say, ideally these cats are coming in one day, getting fixed the next, going back the next, so in and out as quickly as possible. This is the Maui Humane Society's, what we call the TNR Via, where the community cats are held. You can see they're kept in traps. The traps are on tables. They're covered with sheets. They're fed and the traps are cleaned twice a day. If you want to know how to do that, there's a video we've made that shows that. You can just click on the link, you know, download the handout for the slides and click on that link. And we have a step-by-step demonstration of how you use trap dividers to section the cat off on one end while you open the other and do your feeding and cleaning. You can house them in traps on tables or racks, like we showed. If they're going to be put in cages, maybe because that's the setup at the shelter, or the cats can't, because of scheduling, they have to stay for longer than you're comfortable keeping them in traps, although cats can be kept in traps for several days with no problems. The best thing is to have a feral cat den, like you see in this photo. So you can move the cat in and out of the cage while the cat's confined in the den, and not open the cage door and hope he doesn't run out. If you don't know what feral cat dens are, they have these side doors. You see that round door sticking up on the right of your slide? So the cat goes in and you can take a broomstick or a ruler and you can tip that door closed and then open the steel cage door and take the den out without the cat escaping. Most programs keep the cats in their traps unless they're going to be kept for longer than normal stay. If you have a stray hold period that's crimping your program, like it says something like you have to hold cats for 7 days before you can do anything with them, you know, that can be a real obstacle to a return to field program that's trying to move quickly. Just wanted to give you, there is hope. Like in Arizona, I won't read it, but this is a state law they passed that waived the stray hold for a return to field. So legislatively, that would be the way to go about it. It doesn't have to be the state. It might be your municipality or your county, but try to get an exemption from the stray hold for return to field cats. So the surgery, again, you want to get it done as quick as possible. It's kind of standard treatment, spay neuter, ear tip, rabies vaccine, if it's legally required. Optional treatments, you know, FERCP, parasites, dental, if you have that ability, injuries and illness. And typical recovery time is overnight. So the cats are fixed on Monday. Barring any complications, they're released on Tuesday. Who does the returns? Well, you know, the multiple options. You can have staff do it. You can have ACOs do it, volunteers or partner groups. Here's a pre-return checklist. These are the things you want to look at before you take the cat out of the shelter and put them in the van. Make sure there's medical. Have somebody with a vet tech or veterinarian put eyes on the cat one more time to make sure there's no complications. Check the ID, the photo on the tracking form to make sure you got the right cat and remove any collars or things like that. If your shelter leans towards keeping social cats for adoption, then check again what their temperament is. They may have calmed down after a couple of days. Verify the address by entering it into Google Maps and make sure the address exists. You can scout the release site by entering the address into Google Maps or a similar app. And that's what you see in this slide. You can zoom in and you can look at exactly where you're going to go and whether or not that's a good spot to be releasing the cat. And of course, make sure the trap or the den is secure before you lift it up. Things to think about with returns is the weather. If it's poor weather, you can wait. Do you do it at day, during the day or at night? That might depend on if it's a heavily trafficked area during the day, like a shopping center or industrial area, then you might want to wait till it's at night when it's quieter or busy street, things like that. How close are you going to be? The adult cats can be, you know, at least a couple of blocks away. They're going to know that neighborhood. Kittens, the younger they are, the closer they need to be to the actual, released to the actual location found. Is there going to be a caretaker present? If there is one that's known, have they been contacted? And are there any issues with a hostile finder? And that's why you want to note in the beginning what the finder's attitude is about the whole thing. Because if they're hostile and you want to avoid any kind of confrontation when you're doing the release, you can just let the cat go a block away. Or depending on their age, you can find that you can go behind the house instead of in front of the house, things like that. That's where the Google Map scouting comes in real handy. Is it public versus private property? You don't want to be trespassing onto private property. You would want to release the cat as close to the on public property, as close as you can. Kittens, again, if we're dealing with neonates or very young kittens, then you want to make more of an effort to locate the feeder and somebody who can help with that. But the basic idea with kittens is they need to be returned as close as possible to where they were captured. If you have neonates and a mom that you're returning, you might stick around because maybe the mom will run off, but she should come back pretty quickly and start moving the kittens herself to what she considers a safe spot. If you ever do have to deal with confrontation, you want to have literature on hand that explains your program that you can just hand to somebody. You don't want to get into a prolonged argument. If somebody is being argumentative, then you want to pack up and go. If you haven't released the cat yet, then put him back in the van and come back at a different time, maybe a little bit further away. So I want to talk real quickly about how you can combine after the return to field and targeted TNR if the goal is not only to reduce euthanasia, but to also reduce the number of cats coming into the shelter in the first place. So when we talk about return to field in terms of population, now we're talking not so much, we're not talking about reducing euthanasia at the shelter. That's, we've already accomplished that. Now we want to also reduce the number of cats in the community so that we don't have so many RTF cats coming in the first place. So when we do return to field, and we do one cat and they're part of a colony, this is what it looks like, right? There's 10 cats in this backyard colony and one of them is fixed. So that's great for this cat. It's probably not going to do anything to reduce the population because the other 9 cats can still reproduce, right? So whatever the carrying capacity of that area is, that's the number of cats there's going to be even after this one cat is returned. When you look at it on a community view, and we're doing RTF alone, and this is what it looks like. We're randomly returning, fixing and returning one cat. Maybe we'll occasionally get 2 or 3 cats out of a colony fixed. But this kind of trapping, as you can see, is tends to be very inefficient and random. So still a valuable program, but you're not getting any population reduction out of this. So if we combined returning the cat, and we use the cat as what we call a red flag for, hey, if somebody brought a cat in from this location that wasn't fixed, there's probably others. So we send our trapping team or our TNR partner to that location to get the rest of them fixed. Then it can start to look like this. And it's not just the RTF cat that's spayed and neutered. It's all the other cats too. And now we can start to achieve the population going down if we can eliminate reproduction. And that's what this looks like on a community level, is you have your red circle RTF cats serving as scouts and red flags, and then you're following up with those colonies and getting the majority or as close to 100% of them fixed as you can. And over time, this can achieve reduced intake. Another way of doing this that's even more impactful in terms of intake is not to target colonies, but to target areas. So you don't follow up at the location for every RTF cat. You follow up and you do your focused targeted TNR on the parts of your community where there is the highest number of community cats. So the RTF cats may serve as scouts within that zip code, for example, like we see here, zip code 3, but you're focusing on getting as many cats in that zip code fixed as you can, whether there's an RTF cat involved or not. That will allow you to get high sterilization rates, not just in colonies, but in areas. And that reduces immigration and it helps, as populations are dropping, it helps to eliminate the vacuum effect of new cats coming in. This is community level targeting as opposed to what I was talking about before, which we would call colony level targeting. So you can do either approach to help bring the cat, to combine TNR with targeted TNR with return to field and start to bring the population down. So this approach was actually done at these 6 different shelters over the period of, I think it was 3 years. And you can see how obviously the euthanasia rate, the bottom 2 lines, the average was an 83% drop in euthanasia among all cats, adult and kitten. And that, you can see, is pretty strong across the board. You've got a low of 59% and a high of 91%. That's the return to field part. That's instead of euthanizing cats, putting them back. But these programs all added targeted TNR as an element to their program. And so you can see intake also went down. Not by as much, but still pretty substantially. All cats down 32% on average and kittens down 40%. So when you combine those two, you really get the most bang for your buck. And this is Albuquerque Animal Welfare Department, which is one of those 6 communities I talked about. And you can see the data here in a little bit more detail. And notice how the Return to Field program, I believe it began in 2011. And euthanasia, of course, goes right down. Intake stays up. Over time, euthanasia continues to drop. And then intake also starts to come down too due to the targeting. And also notice how the number of RTF cats started to go down as well, because you've got fewer RTF cats coming in. So it's that combination of return to field and targeting that is kind of the most powerful shelter program that we know when it comes to community cats.
And with that, I will say thank you so much to Brian and Susie for lending us your expertise, those big brains and all that experience that we all are here to learn from.
Thank you, Kristen.
That's it for this week. Please head over to Apple Podcasts and leave a review. We love to hear what you think, and a 5-star review really helps others find the show. You can also join the conversation with listeners, cat caretakers, and me on Facebook and Instagram. And don't forget to hit follow or subscribe on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, YouTube, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to podcasts so you don't miss a single show. Thanks for listening, and thank you for everything that you do to help create a safe and healthy world for cats.